Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 23rd, 2006. Our session today is entitled Citizen Power and Money Power in the Quest for Peace for Holy Land Conflict. Our presenter is Charles Lutz, LUC 2006-08. Let's listen in.
And welcome. I'm Chuck Lutz, and this is the third this week in a series on the Holy Land. And it's my last time with you because my wife and I are leaving the village tomorrow. But the series will continue with Heidi Schramm doing three more sessions, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, based on her experience with Christian peacemaker teams in the West Bank. And so she'll be with you at whatever the assigned times are on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And she's going to talk especially about the impact on the Palestinians of the security barrier, the wall that Israel's building within Palestinian territory, the impact of the Israeli settlements on the West Bank, and I don't recall what her third session will deal with, but it'll be on the same, I think it'll be on the same general subject.
Alive in the village, she said.
Alive
in the village, she said.
Oh, okay.
A day in the village.
Yeah. All right. I'd like to begin with a prayer that comes from the students at Bethlehem Bible College, a Christian institution in Bethlehem. And this is something that they circulated a couple years ago on their website and by email. And it focuses on the economic distress that Bethlehem was in and is really still in. Because of the loss of tourism, Bethlehem's economy for centuries has depended on Christian pilgrims coming to visit the city of Jesus' birth, and that had pretty well dried up. And so I invite you to join me in this prayer that comes from the students in Bethlehem. Let us pray that God will lift the cloud of depression. Pray that the people in their distress will look to Him as their only provider. Let us pray for the restoration of our economy, especially tourism, on which the town almost totally depends. Let us pray that God will give ideas to business people and entrepreneurs for projects that do not rely totally on tourism. Pray that God will give them the resources and the ability to carry out these projects. Let us pray for a good season of rain and for abundance that the trees will produce enough to meet the need. And let us pray for the wall to tumble down and to be dismantled peacefully. Amen. What we're going to do today is talk about two tools that we in the United States have that we can use to press the quest for a just peace in the Holy Land. One is our economic power, our resources, and how we steward those resources intentionally in a way that will be helpful for the peace process. And the other is our citizenship power, our power as political beings in a system where the voice of constituents can have some effect on the action of our elected representatives. So we'll talk about political advocacy, but first we'll talk about economic power. And before we do that, I'm going to show a video. It runs about 28 minutes. It's called Searching for Peace in the Middle East. It's a film done by Landrum Bowling. Landrum Bowling is a longtime peacemaker, and he's an American Quaker, an American friend. He was president of Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana for some years. Then he was director of the Tantur Ecumenical Studies Center in Jerusalem for 4 years. And he's often been involved as a consultant to teams, peacemaker teams, that have been working on the issue, including in 2000, Senator George Mitchell. And he basically did this video to lift up what are the issues that are involved that have to be dealt with before there will be a just peace in the Holy Land. The video is available free for those who want to order it and make use of it. It's being distributed by a group called the Mercy Corps. Some of you may know of the Mercy Corps. They're actually based in Portland, Oregon. But the address, postal address, email address, and telephone number for making inquiry about the video, I have on the board. And you can, if you're interested, you can copy it down later. And as I say, it's available free for those who want to order it. So, searching for peace in the Middle East. I guess it's moving.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
In the vast area of the Middle East, the Holy Land is only one small sliver. The population of Palestinians and Israelis number fewer than 10 million out of a Middle Eastern population of more than 200 million. And yet, the unresolved quarrel between the Palestinians and the Israelis, the seemingly endless bloody struggle over control of the land, this has created a situation that disturbs not only the peace of the region, but threatens the peace of the whole world. The Holy Land, so it has been called by millions of devout believers over many centuries, a land sacred to Jews, Christians, and Muslims, often also the scene of unspeakable violence. After the collapse of the Camp David talks in the summer of 2000 and the outbreak of the Second Intifada, the two sides resorted to the most horrible violence against one another. Each with stubborn self-righteousness blamed the other of indiscriminately killing hundreds of innocent civilians, many women and children. On that harsh judgment of each other, both were correct. For 4 years after 2000, Israel was traumatized by suicide bombings, buses, restaurants, crowded shopping streets. Around 1,000 Israelis killed, including many children. Israeli retaliation has always been swift and overpowering. In the same period, almost 4,000 Palestinians and their children lost their lives through Israeli military action. I've watched the tragedy of the conflict from the inside, the pain and suffering and the endless negotiations which never seem to lead to a permanent end to the killing. For 4 years as rector of the Tom Tureka Medical Institute between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, I helped bring together Christian, Jewish, and Muslim scholars and religious leaders for study and dialogue, and sometimes high-level unpublicized exchanges on crucial issues. The basic quarrel, of course, is over the land. Under the Armistice Agreement of 1949, Israel held roughly three-quarters of historic Palestine. The Arabs held an area west of the River Jordan, plus the Gaza Strip. The boundary became known as the Green Line. Even Jerusalem was split in two. 18 years later, after the War of 1967, Israel established military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Although they left the Gaza Strip in 2005, the whole of the West Bank remains under Israeli military occupation. This fact incites increasing, continuing anger and resentment among the Palestinians.
The whole system is based on occupying force, subjugating Palestinian people. If you look at the military rules, if you look at the behavior of the soldiers, if you look at the bureaucratic approach of the system here,
On the other hand, Israelis insist that there is now no alternative to a military occupation.
Although we try to deny it, the reason that these people have to be there is because if they weren't there, our families and our children and ourselves would be vulnerable targets and would, as we've seen only too many times, be blown to pieces.
A major issue is the separation barrier built by the Israelis. It's going to be 400 miles long. The purpose is to separate the Palestinians on the West Bank from the Israelis.
It's where we can most effectively stop the terrorists getting to the Jews and the Israelis that are targets for them, wherever they are, on either side of the Green Line.
It is constructed in the middle of the neighborhood. You can see on the right side, Palestinian neighborhood, and on the left side, it's Palestinian neighborhood. So the wall is constructed between Palestinians. 32,000 Palestinians will be on the other side of the wall, and here on this side, about 230,000 Palestinians will be cut off from their relatives, from their families, from the market on the other side.
I went to visit Colonel Benzi Gruber, an Israeli Army reservist, commander of a brigade of 4,000 men. What is his opinion of the wall?
The Persian wall is a very bad solution, really. If you see the way that it goes, you know, in every kilometer it goes something around 10 kilometers like this. It's, you know, not logical. You can't even think about an real army that, you know, can defend stuff like this. And I don't think that this is the end, the solution.
It has become the symbol of everything the Palestinians hate most about the Israeli occupation. For many villagers and farmers, the wall threatens their livelihood, and they try to stop it however they can. Most of the West Bank is rural, and life for village people is precarious. Alongside the wall, the checkpoints represent the worst evils of the occupation. The experience of passing through these checkpoints is, for most Palestinians, an inescapable daily humiliation. Dr. Jad Izak, a leading Palestinian environmentalist, has a research institute in Bethlehem.
When you see the Palestinians, what they are subjected to, when I have to spend 1 hour every time on the checkpoint, going outside Bethlehem, and then another 1 hour getting into Ramallah, and a similar reason going back, and for no reason to be humiliated by the Israeli soldiers as a result of me trying to get from Bethlehem to Ramallah. I go back home at the end of the day so full of anger and so full of bitter feelings that, you know, I have to utilize a lot of efforts to quench this little demon in me who wants to go and revenge.
Every day, our security officials are asking themselves, well, maybe today we can allow in people who are over the age of 30, or people who are married and have children, because they're less of a security risk. And then we'll have an incident like we had 2 weeks ago with a woman who was smuggling in explosives under her baby.
East Jerusalem is home to more than 200,000 Palestinians, some of whose families have lived there for hundreds of years. Their long-term status, however, is seriously in doubt.
One of the difficulties which Palestinians are facing is the house demolition policy by the Israeli Jerusalem municipality. Last year, for example, more than 150 houses was demolished by the municipality under the pretext that it is built without permits. And this is an example of house demolition. You can see it on the... And in this way, less and less Palestinian population are in East Jerusalem.
ever since their extraordinary victory in the Six-Day War of 1967, the Israelis have been building Israeli-Jewish settlements scattered throughout the occupied Palestinian Arab territories. Towns, small outposts, some becoming real cities. For many of the settlers, the very act of living on this land is an assertion of a God-given right. Kiryat Arba is close to the biblical town of Hebron, the home of Abraham. Gary Cooperberg was one of the original settlers.
If you look in the Bible, it's very clearly written that God promised this land to Abraham as an eternal inheritance to him and his children. This vacant hillside became the first major community to be built in the lands that we redeemed in 1967.
In new neighborhoods around Jerusalem and across the West Bank, now live Israeli Jews on lands taken over from the Palestinians. How, ask the Palestinians, can you ever create a viable state with permanent Jewish settlements scattered throughout the proposed new Palestine? Many Palestinians have emigrated over the past 50 years to various foreign countries. Moreover, several hundred thousands of refugees still live in camps in Jordan, in Syria, in Lebanon, here in the West Bank, as well as in Gaza. They have no land of their own and no right of return to their original villages and towns. The El Arub camp is on the road between Bethlehem and Hebron. It was established after the 48-49 war, and many Palestinians, now middle-aged, were born here and have known no other home.
People is very poor in our camp here, and we have many social problems happening between the couple at home.
Yeah. Poverty, unemployment, and above all, resentment at the occupation has encouraged violence. All over the West Bank and Gaza, young Palestinians took to the streets in anger and frustration. The Israeli army was not slow to retaliate.
Oppressive measures which we are subjected to every day are driving Palestinians into extremism and fundamentalism.
A number of extremist organizations, such as Islamic Jihad and the Al-Aqsa Brigade, are well armed. They appeal to young men already seething with anger, who embrace the message that nothing can change Israeli policies except armed resistance. The world was shocked to discover how great is the voter appeal of Hamas. I went to Gaza to meet the Hamas leader, Dr. Mahmoud El-Zahar. In 2003, he survived an assassination attempt by the Israelis that took the life of his son.
What anybody would expect from people like us, if their house is demolished, if their son killed, if their trees are removed, if they change Gaza into a big prison? We started by peaceful methods, and when the international community neglected our national demand, and when the Israelis treated our national demand very aggressively, we resorted to run a self-defense by using guns.
The ultimate and most terrifying form of armed resistance is suicide bombing. Do the people who support suicide bombing believe that this will win them popular support?
The question is not popularity. The question how to convince the other side that their occupation is costing them too much. The aim is to push the Israeli outside. Now, when we succeeded to push them outside Gaza Strip, we stopped them. So it's not our intention to kill a civilian.
I have known Hanan Ashrawi for many years. She was long the most respected public voice of the PLO. I put it to her that the Israelis will not talk while the violence continues.
So far, they have succeeded in holding the peace process hostage to this mentality on the one hand.
And on the other, they have provoked tremendous violence by acts of incitement, like shelling, bombing, house demolitions, uprooting trees, destroying crops, assassinating political leaders, placing all the Palestinians in under closure in a state of total immobility, a prison. And yet, and then they wonder why are some Palestinians acting violently. And so they want to have the right to exercise violence against the captive population and the right to make non-violence on the part of the Palestinians a precondition for the Palestinians to qualify for talks, let alone for statehood.
Close to half of all Palestinians live below the poverty line. Serious unemployment contributes to the attraction to violence. In Ramallah, a group of young Palestinians have formed an organization called Sharik to help other young people do something constructive.
You open, close, finish it up.
They have raised money for computer training. Jobs are easier to find for those who can use a computer. To help village women out of their poverty and frustration, they teach them how to turn their surplus olive oil into soap.
The project was getting the skills of how to produce the olive oil soap. So we're talking about 40 young women who received a full training on producing the olive oil soap and the bottling of the extra virgin of the olive and also the herbs drying and packaging. So we're talking about 40 young women from different villages.
Many Israelis put themselves on the line to help build trust between both sides. Rabbi Arik Asherman heads an organization called Rabbis for Human Rights.
On this particular day, we were at a demonstration. I get a call and I'm told to come over to this neighborhood in the village because a young boy has been caught by the border police. He's being beaten. So I and three other Israelis make our way to where this is happening. I see this young boy strapped to the windshield of one of the jeeps, shivering in fear, unsuccessfully trying to keep back the tears. Who knows what he thinks about all Israelis, perhaps all Jews? But when he gave an affidavit to our fellow human rights organization, B'Tselem, after describing all the terrible things that happened to him, he concluded by saying, and then a tall Jewish man in a kippah came to my rescue and told me not to be afraid. What I do involves risk. Like that day, I've been many times beaten up by Israeli soldiers and security forces. I've been attacked by settlers. And I've had my car stoned by Palestinians. But I will go through all that again and again and again. For the young boy will say that a tall Jewish man in a kippah came to my rescue and told me not to be afraid.
Jonathan Katab is an old friend, a Palestinian lawyer who devotes much of his time to human rights issues.
Everybody knows what it would take to achieve a permanent and lasting peace here.
Both sides agree that.
That addresses the basic interests of both sides. And it's a two-state solution. It's withdrawal of the 67 borders. It's dismantlement of the settlements. It's some kind of shared status for a united Jerusalem.
The capital
for both parties. The West Bank, Gaza, will have to be demilitarized to remove any security threat for Israel. Some solution has to be reached for the refugee problem. Some qualified return, some compensation, some settlement for the Palestinian refugees. I think everybody knows what it takes. The question is there the political will to implement it?
I don't think any difference now between the majority of Israelis and Palestinians in understanding that we have to find some accommodation for both people. And from that point of view, I think there's been immense progress over the last 10, 20 years. And there are two possibilities of how to do it. One is to acknowledge and then to implement the Palestinian right to self-determination and to make sure that solution, the two-state solution, is a just and fair solution which allows for the creation of a viable Palestinian state alongside Israel on the 1967 boundaries, and if there are any changes, they're by agreement on a swap basis. And on the Israeli side, there is the need to maintain a democratic state with a Jewish majority, which can only be achieved through the creation of a Palestinian state alongside Israel.
Deeply embedded into the whole conflict, of course, are issues and symbols of religion. None is more emotionally powerful than the issue of Jerusalem. In addition to being the central holy shrine for Jews and for Christians, Jerusalem is also sacred to Muslims. In the holy month of Ramadan, an endless stream of worshippers winds its way through the old city on the way to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is the third most holy Islamic shrine in the world. For the Jews, this is the Temple Mount, the site of King Solomon's temple, which some ultra-Orthodox Jews now want to restore at the expense of the mosque. Its western wall is sacred beyond measure, the closest spot to the Holy of Holies in the ancient temple. Any settlement would have to work out how both sides would share the city.
We have Jerusalem, which is a very difficult issue because of the symbolism of Jerusalem, but we've seen the negotiations and the talks between Israelis and Palestinians, both at the formal level of the negotiations, track one, and all kinds of track two. We come to more or less the Clinton parameters of what's Arab to the Palestinians, what's Jewish to the Israelis. The Temple Mount, Haram al-Sharif, will be under some kind of Islamic embodiment with Palestinian control of it. The Western Wall, the Kotel, under Israel. This is workable, it's doable, and I think that if there's a belief on both sides that peace is possible, it will also be accepted.
The question of the settlements and their future is perhaps the single most critical issue that has to be solved if peace is ever to come. Despite the convictions of a deeply committed ideological minority, more and more settlers are now so fed up the tensions and the conflict that they are prepared to move out of the settlements if a clear path to peace can be found. Carol Gruber lives in Ephrat, a large settlement near Jerusalem, to which he came 21 years ago.
I will tell you what I think. I think that, as I told it a lot, that I agree to give my property, I agree to give my house back, if I believe that it will be peace. If I agree to risk my life in the, you know, in the army, yes. If I agree that my children will serve in the army, right. So not to give the property for peace, I will give it. The question, if you believe that it will be peace, yeah. You know, so I don't believe that soil is holy, I don't believe that rock is holy, and I don't believe the house is holy. My soul is holy, the soul of my children is holy, not the house. So for me, if I will understand that, okay, that's the way that we have to give, I will give it back. With no any hesitation. We have to find a solution, and I believe that most of the population in Israel, most I mean more than 70%, understand that we have to compromise.
Remarkably, in 2005, in a dramatic and controversial shift in policy, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon decided to pull out 8,000 Israeli settlers and the entire occupying force from the Gaza Strip. Fiercely resisted by many settlers, but supported by most Israelis, the withdrawal was finally achieved without bloodshed.
Well, 7 years ago, on the 4th of September 1997, we lost a daughter to the Palestinian suicide bombers who blew themselves up in Beni Huda,
Jerusalem.
In Jerusalem. And this has changed our lives totally. And from this enormous pain, from this tragedy, we decided to do something with it. in order to try and prevent more bitterness, more pain. So we are engaged in a in an organization which is called the Relief Families Forum for Peace, an Israeli-Palestinian joint organization, which tries to create hope out of this endless pain.
What kinds of things specifically do you do? What activities do you carry out?
Oh, so many things. The most important thing that we do is lectures in high school. Last year we gave more than 1,000 lectures.
In Israel?
In Israel and in Palestine.
And in Palestine.
Yeah, we step into an Israeli or a Palestinian class, usually together with the Palestinian partner, and talk about hope, talk about reconciliation, talk about dialogue. The fact that we are bereaved opens the door, opens the heart, because in the Israeli society and in the Palestinian society, bereaved families are respected tremendously. And this is it, this is the basic of it, looking for when trying to solve this matter, and the only way to solve it is by listening.
To the other?
Yeah, by understanding. You don't have to accept everything, but you have to listen, you have to try and understand. And the basic problem, the essence of everything, is the total blindness of the two sides to the narrative and the pain. And the greatest danger to the future of Israel, the Jewish democratic state in the future, is the continuation of the occupation. And the occupation goes on with the American support. And the minute the Americans will understand it, which the Europeans seem to be understanding it for the last years, then what is necessary will be done. And what is necessary is that the Americans will initiate a peace process which will be just.
I'm talking as the son of a Holocaust survivor. My father is an Auschwitz graduate. And 60 years ago, well, they took my grandparents to the ovens in Europe, the free and civilized world, to the side and never lifted a finger. And today, while these two crazy people are massacring each other, the free and civilized world is still standing aside and almost doing nothing, not only that, but supporting one side almost unconditionally. And what I am begging from people when I end any lecture of mine is not to stand aside, is to show some feeling, some understanding, some and try to solve this horrible conflict before it will finish us all.
The most insistent challenge to all of us is not to stand aside. Since the United States is the only country that clearly has decisive influence with both sides, we have the obligation to provide imaginative diplomacy backed by our wealth and power. The President, the Secretary of State, and the Congress should hear from the American people that we support full, unflagging, determined work to make a negotiated peace happen.
Turn on the lights. Here is the data on the video searching for peace in the Middle East, which you can copy down later if you're interested in ordering it. I think it's a useful tool for local church education and in other settings. because it really it hears from representatives of both peoples, both sides, and it outlines at toward the end the strategy for political advocacy that is called for Americans, and the role of the United States is obviously going to be very significant, very crucial for any final settlement. You want to talk a little bit about what was in the video? Any questions or concerns raised? Any observations you have before we go on? Okay. When people ask, what can we do? What? Now I know about that situation, that conflict, but what can I do? What can I do to be useful? I like to talk about four P's. One is prayer, particularly corporate prayer, the prayer of the church, to keep the peace of Jerusalem and the peace of the Holy Land on the agenda of the people of God, and to keep us reminded of the fact that it's a significant agenda item for the people of faith in the United States and around the world. The second is the P of pilgrimage, to make visits. We're continually urged by not only the Christian community in the Holy Land, but by Palestinians and Israelis generally, to come and be with them, to come and learn from them, and to be in solidarity with them. Particularly the peace and human rights groups are urging that, and the Christian congregations are urging that. Christians say they feel abandoned by the world Christian community. They feel that they're being ignored and that their plight is being forgotten, and they want us to come and be with them, even if it's only for short-term visits of 10 days to 2 weeks. And it has significance also for the economy, especially of the Palestinians, because of their historic dependence on Christian pilgrims to come and buy their craft items, to buy their olive oil and other kinds of products that the Palestinians produce. And particularly the Palestinian Christians have depended on that, to use their hotels, to use their bus drivers, their guide service, to use their restaurants and so forth. And that has been declined significantly in the last years. The third P is the pressure of our economic power. And the fourth P is public policy advocating. And it's the last two that I want to talk about some in the remainder of our hour this morning. Using economic tools in the quest for Holy Land peace. There are basically three things we can do with money. One is to donate it, another is to spend it, to purchase things with it, and the third is to lend it, to invest it. Talking about the last first, there has been in the last couple of years a major controversy developing in the churches of North America about whether church investment money should be divested from companies, U.S. companies, that are working in the Holy Land and particularly in support of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. One of those companies, for example, is Caterpillar, that has been identified, because Caterpillar has provided specially made machines for the use of the Israeli military in demolishing Palestinian homes and in constructing the wall and so forth. That's been extremely controversial, not only within the church. The Presbyterian Church USA voted in 2004 to explore that, not to do any divesting yet, but to explore it. And that led to a major discussion within the Presbyterian Church and in other churches about whether that was an appropriate thing to do, whether it was helpful, whether it was anti-Semitic, whether it was unnecessarily judgmental about Israel and so forth. But it also led to a major controversy between Presbyterians and the American Jewish community. The American Jewish community, for the most part, responded very negatively to that action. They did not like it. They resented it. It was branded as an anti-Semitic act, even to talk about it, and not only not to divest yet, but even to discuss it as a possibility. And so that dialogue, that conversation goes on, and other churches have looked at the same issue. The ELCA, my own denomination, last year in Orlando Assembly in Florida, adopted a strategy document for engagement with the Middle East issues, Holy Land conflict. And it has a lot of elements to it, but one element is the stewarding of economic resources. It does not call for divestment. It does call, in a rather, I would say, ambiguous way, for investing in ways that will be supportive of the quest for peace and that will be supportive of economic development, in the particularly among those who are most in need, the Palestinians. Other churches have acted on the divestment question. I have a document here from a publication of Americans for Middle East Understanding called The Link. The whole issue is devoted to the divestment question. And this author advocates divestment. He thinks it is a way to go. And I'll make that available for any of you who are interested in pursuing that issue. I don't have enough copies for everybody, but you can pick that up later if you're particularly interested. So the issue of investments and divesting has become a significant one in this entire debate about how do we use our economic power as American Christians in a way that is supportive of peace and justice in the Holy Land. Another issue involving money is how we spend it. And there are Israeli peace organizations that advocate that Westerners, Europeans and North Americans, not buy, that they boycott products that are made in the Israeli settlements. And there's a major campaign in the European community. The European Union, in its trade agreement with Israel, has a provision that products from the settlements that are under international law viewed as illegal on Palestinian land not be traded in Europe. They have a website. You can find it in the book Christians in a Land Called Holy, along with a number of other websites that are helpful on the peace effort. The website of Gush Shalom, which is Hebrew for peace block, lists by name, by brand name and identification, the products that are made in the Israeli settlements, and they encourage people not to buy those products. But in a more positive way, there's developed a movement to sell Palestinian products in the U.S. and Europe that come from farm, olive oil particularly, and other products from Palestinian agriculture, but also craft items made by Palestinians, olive wood carvings, embroidery, ceramics, and so forth. And there's developed quite a movement to make those products available for purchase through the churches. In Minnesota, we've got a person who's developed a ministry called Branch of Hope. And she borrows from the image, biblical imagery of the olive branch. And she has developed a way of making Palestinian craft items available for purchase in local churches, as well as olive oil. And so there's that effort, the effort to make intentional decisions in our purchasing of things from the Middle East that favors the people who are most in poverty, which is the Palestinians. As I said, the Palestinian economy used to depend heavily on, particularly the livelihood of Palestinian Christians, on Christian pilgrims. And when the pilgrims stop coming, they don't have a market. So they've now formed cooperatives and tried to market their goods in North America and Europe. And the third way we can use our economic resources is to donate, to give. And we can give to support ministries of the churches in the Holy Land and ministries that really are addressing the peace effort. We can give to support Christian peacemaker teams. We can give to support the Ecumenical Accompaniment Program, which is an effort of the World Council of Churches to take people from around the world, from the churches, for three-month periods of service in the Holy Land, doing things similar to what the Christian peacemaker teams do, which is to be a kind of buffer, an international presence between the conflicting parties in venues where there is violence, in venues where there is conflict.
John, quick, just clarification, our own ELCA World Hunger Appeal
yes.
has given grants to folks in Lebanon, and do you see a flow of grants and support coming via the Hunger Appeal and our Lutheran dollars through there?
Yes, in fact, I was going to move next to that. The World Hunger gifts of ELCA Lutheran, and actually of Missouri Synod Lutherans too, through Lutheran World Relief, the support of those programs have for many decades been supporting programs mostly of humanitarian relief among the Palestinians. The Lutheran World Federation operates a hospital on the Mount of Olives, Augusta Victoria Hospital. Which provides some special medical services for Palestinians that are available to them nowhere else. Some cancer treatment programs and dialysis. Palestinians throughout the West Bank depend on that hospital. It's supported by the World Lutheran Community. And part of its support comes from the gifts to the Hunger Appeal of U.S. Lutherans. The Lutherans also support a vocational school in the northern area of Jerusalem, in Beit Hanina, called the Secondary Vocational School. It provides 2 years of training in particular crafts, in particular skill areas for blue-collar workers, auto mechanics, masonry, carpentry, computer technology. And it's a program that that trains young Palestinians, most of whom happen to be Muslim, because it's available to all any Palestinians for jobs that are available, for work that is available. There are other examples of church programs in the Holy Land that are supportive of the economic development among Palestinians and that are providing basic services, both educational and medical. What else? We have, on the Mount of Olives, the Lutherans have just launched an effort to construct homes, 84 units, 84 apartment units on the Mount of Olives around near the hospital. The Lutherans have a magnificent property there, about 120 acres. Most of it's in olive groves, which is appropriate for the Mount of Olives. They also produce olive oil out of those olive groves to sell in the world Christian community, basically for support of the hospital. But they're going to take 4 acres and build housing there for Christian families who are being increasingly squeezed out of East Jerusalem by Israeli policies and who have no alternative, but many of them, to emigrate. In an effort to help Christians stay in East Jerusalem, the Lutherans are building 84 units of housing, and they hope to break ground this fall and have the apartments ready for occupancy about a year from now. They're raising $8 million worldwide. $2 million is, they hope, to come from the U.S. And so I have a brochure here titled Christians in the Holy Land Need Our Help. It's about that project and how people here, if they wish, can contribute to it. So let me share that with you, and it's just another example of how we could be involved with our financial resources in helping people in the Holy Land. Another is the Palestinian Lutheran schools. Because of the economic distress within the Palestinian territories these days, those 5 schools, all of the Lutheran congregations in the West Bank have schools. And they're all available and enroll intentionally about half Christian and half Muslim students. They're all in financial distress. And so supporting those schools and their scholarship funds for people who can't pay tuition is another thing we can be supportive of. Let me now just turn very briefly to the issue of our political advocacy. organization that I work for that does advocacy with Congress and with the White House is called Churches for Middle East Peace. It's a coalition of 21 denominational agencies in Washington, including the ELCA, but other mainline denominations, Protestant denominations, Catholic agencies, and Orthodox agencies. And they have come together to advocate for a political solution in the Holy Land that squares with what those churches have stated is their policy. And let me just share with you by quoting it for you the basis for our advocacy. This is what Churches for Middle East Peace and its member participating churches support. We are Christians called to express our concerns for peace in Israel and Palestine. We pray for peace in the Holy Land and urge our country's leaders to do all in their power to prepare the road for a long and lasting peace. We believe that one of the primary outcomes of peace negotiations must be a viable Palestinian state living in peace alongside the State of Israel. For a state of Palestine to be viable, all Israeli settlement activity in the occupied territories must cease. We believe in the vision of a shared Jerusalem as the heritage, hope, and home of two peoples and three religions. Jerusalem should be a shared open city, a sign of peace, and a symbol of reconciliation for the Abrahamic faith. We support a UN-sponsored negotiated agreement for peace and the application of international law in all aspects of an Israeli-Palestinian-Arab peace process. We strongly support a multinational presence of observers in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem as one immediate means of discouraging further violence between Palestinians and Israelis. What we do under the umbrella of Churches for Middle East Peace is lobbying with members of Congress, and we do a lot of speaking in local churches. And in Minnesota, where I do the organizing work for Churches for Middle East Peace, we have a speakers bureau, people available to go. We also do work with local area Muslim and Jewish groups and try to have a conversation, continuing conversation with them about U.S. policy. What else? We can support policy change in the United States regarding the use of our tax dollars. The U.S. Ever since Camp David talks under Jimmy Carter in the late 70s, the U.S. has been giving to Israel, no strings attached, $3 to $4 billion a year. Most of it in the form, two-thirds of it in the form of military aid, the rest for general economic support. We give that kind of aid to no other country in the world. All of the continent of Africa, which has serious economic situation, receives less than we give to the State of Israel. We had been giving some aid to the Palestinian Authority, about $150 million a year, but we've stopped that, we the United States government, because the Palestinians elected Hamas candidates to a majority of the seats in the Palestinian legislature, and we don't approve of Hamas because Hamas has not sworn off violence, use of violence and resistance, and Hamas has not officially recognized the State of Israel and its right to exist.
I'm sorry, has Israel sworn off violence yet?
No.
Have we sworn off violence yet?
No. So one of the lobbying efforts that we engaged in through Churches for Middle East Peace this spring was when both the House and the Senate had bills before them to cut off our aid to the Palestinian Authority. And a friend of mine in Minnesota, Betty McCollum, who represents the district that includes the eastern part of the metro area, Twin Cities, St. Paul and its suburbs, Betty became, really with the encouragement from church people who lobbied with her, an outspoken critic of the legislation that would cut off aid to the Palestinian Authority. She supported our routing that aid still to the Palestinian people by other means, through non-governmental organizations and so on. Because that cutting off of aid affects not just the Palestinian Authority, Palestinian government structure, but the Palestinian people. including people who were getting medical services at Augusta Victoria Hospital, because some of that money had been channeled to the hospital from the Palestinian Authority. Well, Betty became an outspoken critic in the House Foreign Relations Committee of that legislation. It finally passed in the House. A similar bill in the Senate was much less onerous, but the House bill did pass despite Betty's efforts to speak against it. But she became the voice of opposition to that bill, and for it she was attacked publicly by AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which said she was pro-terrorist. Mm-hmm. That's how they interpreted her opposition to that bill. And that made her so angry that she said, until she got a public apology from the Jewish lobbying group in America, she would never again allow them to enter her office or deal with her aides on anything until they apologized. As far as I know, they haven't yet apologized. But anyway, that's just one example of the kind of work that we try to do with legislators. And often we don't succeed. We don't get a final result that is what we're advocating, but we do it anyway, and we need to continue the effort. My own House member, Martin Sable, a fellow Lutheran who's now retiring from the House after 20-some years of service there, when our groups of church folk meet with him along this kind of lobbying agenda, he always says to us, thank you for coming, thank you for talking with me. I don't hear very much from people like you. I hear a lot from both the Christian right, the Christian Zionists, and from the Jewish lobby, but I don't hear much from people who have a different perspective out of the churches. And so he encourages us to continue the effort. And I think, as the video indicated, it's one of the things that God really is calling the American Christian constituency to do, to be more active in our pressing our own government for a change in its policies. And that means a change to a more even-handed, a less pro-Israel, not necessarily more pro-Palestinian, but pro-peace, a more balanced approach than we've had in the recent years. Let me pass out some other items here that relate to Churches for Middle East Peace. This is a packet for congregational use, and it's really addressed to clergy and other congregational leaders. So if you fill, and it's things that can be done in the parish educationally and in terms of, it calls for a letter that clergy send to the administration, to the White House, to President Bush. If you are such a person and feel so minded, you can pursue that. But it's really for church congregation leaders, and if you are one of those, want to take it back to your congregation, please take it. The other piece is more general for Churches for Middle East Peace, what it does, who's involved with it, and what its objectives are. And so I can pass that around too.
Chuck, could I do a little announcement?
Yep.
I went to the Ecumenical Advocacy Days, maybe the
in Washington?
It might have been the first one that was held. I don't really know. But anyway.
3 or 4 years ago was the first one. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would just encourage anybody to go to that. I really learned a lot. I mean, the speakers that they had were fantastic. And,
yeah, it's a group of folks from across the country. Last year, there were about 1,000 of us. I've gone every year the last 4 years, and they have several tracks, mostly on international issues, U.S. foreign policy. And there's one track always on the Middle East, and Churches for Middle East Peace helps to sponsor that. And we spend 2.5 days, Friday evening through Sunday, on input, hearing speakers, getting guidance on policy issues that are before the U.S. Congress. And then we spend the last day, Monday, in Hill visits. Visits to offices of House members and senators. And usually you meet with aides, international affairs aides, rather than with the House member, because the House member usually isn't available. But anyway, that's a good thing to do, and it's every March.
What's the name of that?
Ecumenical Advocacy Days. And you can find out about Ecumenical Advocacy Days and about the work of Churches for Middle East Peace from time to time as issues come up by going to the CMEP website, which is www.cmep.org. And then there are links for connecting with various aspects of the issue, including what the program for advocacy days will be in the coming year, the coming March. Other thing I wanted to mention is, if any of you have interest in picking up this book, and a lot of what I've been doing here in teaching has been the themes from this book, Christians in a Land Called Holy, How We Can Foster Justice, Peace, and Hope. I co-authored it, it appeared earlier this year from Fortress, co-authored with Robert Smith. Robert is Lutheran campus pastor at the University of Chicago. He's working on a PhD at Baylor with Mark Ellis, who is an American Jewish scholar, and his doctoral work is focusing on the intersection of faith and politics in the Holy Land, out of the three Abrahamic faith traditions and the political realities of the Holy Land conflict. Anyway, there's going to be a book signing this afternoon at the entry area to the bookstore at 2 o'clock.
2 o'clock.
Yeah.
Do you have 5 good books?
Pardon?
I didn't. I was just hoping I forgot to look for that one. But do you have quite a few? Or?
I think they seem to have about a couple dozen still on their stack. They had more than that last week, but we sold some last week. So, but I think there's still a couple dozen left. There will also be a signing of the book by is it John Leonard, the storyteller, who's here doing with his wife Lila doing workshops on the Enneagram. I don't know if any of you have been involved with that, but John is going to be signing his book too. Any last observations, comments, announcements any of you have? Okay, well, if you're here the next 3 days or any part of the next 3 days, try to dip into the sessions that Heidi Schramm will be doing, really continuing on this same subject, but out of her experience as a Christian peacemaker in the Hebron area of the West Bank.
Are you done? Are you leaving?
Yeah, I'm leaving tomorrow morning.
Oh.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
So Christians,
thank you.
The Christians really have a big role over there.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. The Christian community there, which is tiny percentage-wise, about 1.5%, about 150,000 left out of 10 million, and it continued to shrink because of emigration. But they see themselves as kind of a bridge community between the majority Jewish and majority Muslim communities, respectively. And they see that as their calling under God, to be a bridge community and to bring people together to deal with each other in dialogue. And the international Christian community has a major presence also there. And so, you know, we are involved and need to be involved more intentionally, I think. And so go to it.
Thank you.
If you want to get the video, the Landrum Bowling video, here's the information on how to get that. And thank you very much. Thank you.